Everybody, this is Kelly Mason and Leslie Carson, and you're listening to episode 4 of our Early Intervention podcast. I'm going to go ahead and apologize on behalf of Leslie and myself for the podcast with Dana falling off the tracks at the end of last month. We were not able to communicate without laughing towards the end there. It was one of those instances where you hear someone laugh and then you laugh and it just goes on and on and on. All right, Leslie, let's get to today.
Yes. Episode 4, titled From Restaurant to Brestrant, is with our guest, Kelsey Hare. She's a registered nurse, and Caitlin White, a speech language pathologist. They're both in early intervention and certified lactation counselors, and they're going to share common reasons why they may get a referral to early intervention and the questions that they get asked most. But before we bring Kelsey and Caitlin on, hey, Kelly, tell me something good.
Okay, today's Tell Me Something Good will require a little bit of homework on the listener's part. I don't typically watch the news, but just happened to catch this clip at the end of ABC News World Tonight a few weeks ago, and it really warmed my heart. It's about a rescue dog named Mowgli. A rescue organization in Kentucky learned Mowgli lived outside during the snowy, frigid winter. To get him into their care, they set up a trap. It was the first step in saving Mowgli, but the rescue organization learned the pup had a long road ahead as he immediately froze with fear and uneasiness. After being rescued, Mowgli refused to come out of the crate, which was left open constantly for him to come and go as he pleased. That's when the organization knew it would take time for this hurt and abandoned dog to heal. But after 11 days, they finally got to celebrate a huge milestone for Mowgli, and he left the crate. You may be thinking, Kelly, I don't want to watch a sad dog video and insert that Sarah McLachlan music here, but it's not sad. It's really heartwarming. So pause and look up Mowgli on ABC World News tonight or watch it later. I promise you will not regret it.
I actually did look up this clip. Kelly sent it to me earlier, and it is very heartwarming, and he is such a cute dog. And I encourage everybody to take a peek at this clip. Well, moving on to our episode today, we're going to welcome Kelsey and Caitlin. Thank you for joining us. And we'd love to hear how each of you started your journey to become a lactation counselor.
Yes, thank you guys so much for having us. I'm Caitlin White, speech language pathologist and now a certified lactation counselor. And I will say I love watching the dog rescue videos where it just is a very heartwarming story every time.
Mm-hmm. I know, it's a good one.
So I earned my degree in speech language pathology in 2018 and have been working in early intervention ever since. My journey to become a lactation counselor started, though, after my first son was born 4 weeks early back in 2021. And I quickly learned that breastfeeding just does not always come as naturally as I thought it would, especially going from bottle feeding in the hospital, trying to nurse him at home. It just was not an easy process. So then once I was back from maternity leave, you know, being in the early intervention world, I just saw an opening and thought this would be a perfect way to help moms in this field that I was already working in. So I received my certification as a lactation counselor in 2022, and then recently got my continuing education to be an advanced lactation consultant just this year. So it's been fun working on that ever since.
That's awesome. And I would agree with you, Caitlin. I remember after having my daughter, I thought that you just like held the baby to your breast and it was just like this magical, beautiful thing. And they fed and I'm like, what in the world is happening here?
Oh, yes. And of course, every time I would go to the lactation consultant at my doctor's office, it would be like a perfect feeding. And I'm like, wait, this is not how this looks at home.
Yeah. Yeah.
Congratulations on your advanced consultant.
Thank you.
Certificate.
Yeah. It's been a fun journey.
Well, I'm Kelsey Hare, and I am a registered nurse. And my path to becoming a lactation counselor is a little bit of a longer, windy road, but I'm going to try to share it in a concise way because I think some of our listeners will be able to relate to this path as well. My first degree is in journalism and mass communications. This was, I'm going to say, during the computer era when computers first became a thing and the internet took over the world of newspaper. I quickly learned that there was not going to be a job for me to be a newspaper editor. And also, radio is really hard to find a job in. So I kept doing what I had done throughout college, and I waited tables. So with my college degree, I was a server at a restaurant. They quickly promoted me to a restaurant supervisor, and I learned that was not a career for me. I did not love late nights, and the dinner rush was getting to me. So I switched within that company to become a human resources manager. This was a better fit for me, and I did that for about 5 years until my second child was born. At that point, I stayed home. This was about a 10-year gap where I was home raising kids. I was also teaching preschool part-time during this time, and we moved 3 cities with my husband's job, so just a lot going on. It was when my fourth child was born. I remember being in the hospital and telling my husband that I knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. And that was a labor and delivery nurse. And so I went back to nursing school and got my degree as a registered nurse. But along that journey, I realized I did not love labor and delivery. I did not love the adrenaline rush. I did not love the excitement. I like more of a sit down, relaxed, hey, let's talk this through path, which I got to follow some lactation counselors in the hospital as part of my clinical rotations. And I knew at that point that is what I wanted to do. So I too got my certified lactation counselor after getting my registered nurse. And here I am in early intervention, getting to do what I love.
Well, and it's all come full circle for you being on this podcast with the journalism, you know, degree.
I know. Thank you for helping me live this dream.
Yes, yes. Next time I'll get you a professional microphone like I have. Okay. I am fascinated to hear about breastfeeding. I first must address that while preparing for this podcast, Kelsey was the one that came up with the creative name From Restaurant to Breastaurant. It is really actually hard to say. Turns out all 4 of us have had experiences working in restaurants. So we will play a fun short game later to tie this all together.
I cannot wait, but we're going to get our learn on first, Kelly. So our first question, Caitlin, could you tell us how and why a family would be referred to early intervention for breastfeeding concerns?
Yes, absolutely. We receive referrals for a variety of reasons, but most commonly it's because mom is having pain while breastfeeding or baby isn't gaining weight like we would hope. We, of course, help moms with a variety of problems they might be having to help problem solve things like how to increase milk supply, pump correctly, and improve baby's latch. So those are the most common reasons we get referrals for breastfeeding and early intervention. And Kelsey actually has been working very hard on our community outreach. So we've been getting a lot of referrals from pediatricians, which has been great because they are, you know, of course, the first people that moms and babies are seeing after baby's born. And, you know, like I mentioned, when you leave the hospital, you're like just in a daze and everything's going well, as they say, and then you get home and it's like, what is happening? So it's nice to get some of those referrals. And then for our program specifically, we also just take referrals from moms themselves going to our website, giving us a call, and then we reach out to them as soon as we can. We've found, you know, a lot of moms maybe have had older siblings in our program, so they're familiar with us, or word of mouth just from friends. So we're working to get the word out there, but those are kind of the overall process of what it looks like for referrals.
That's great. Is there a way to fast track these referrals since nursing is something that usually needs to be addressed pretty quickly?
Yes. So this is one of the things we've adapted specifically for the lactation referrals. And this is Kelsey speaking. I get those referrals sent directly to me once they come into the system. And then I'm the one who gets to call mom and talk through whatever the concerns are. I try to get those phone calls done within 2 business days because I know that it's really important to get in there and start helping right away. Caitlin and I typically go out together to do the evaluation in the family's home. And we like to get those done within, hopefully, 5 days of that referral coming in so that we don't miss out on any opportunities to get things going down a more positive route.
That's great. And just kind of for our knowledge, what have you seen? What growth have you seen? I guess like thinking from when the referrals started till now, would you say those referral numbers have increased?
Yes, for sure. So when we first rolled this out, we started working with parents as teachers within our local school districts, and they were referring families to us that they knew had some concerns with lactation. And then once we got that going, that's when we started reaching out to local pediatrician and healthcare providers. And there is still room for growth. We're going to add some more lactation counselors on our team in the future. And we're just really hoping to grow this within our community.
That's great. Well, thinking about that lactation evaluation, and you mentioned that you and Kelsey or Caitlin try to go out within 5 days. Tell us a little bit more about that. What does the evaluation entail? What tools do you use to determine if a baby will receive services? What are some things that, you know, are there observations or what do you do to make that decision?
So overall, the lactation evaluations look fairly similar to just a typical early intervention evaluation. We get a lot of information from mom about pregnancy, birth history, health history, and then we walk through, you know, a daily routine. But Kelsey and I always say there's not much of a routine with newborns. It's pretty much eating, sleeping, and pooping. But we walk through what all of that looks like to get a good picture of what their day-to-day looks like, especially regarding feeding. And then, you know, if timing works, because babies always like to throw us for a loop. So if timing works out, we would love to watch a nursing session just to see how that's going and what it typically looks like in their home. And then we look for things like the quality of the latch, mom's nipple shape after the feeding and her pain levels. And then we listen closely to the suck swallow ratio of the baby when at the breast. And we will also observe some bottle feeding too, if that's a concern, to see if we can support there. And then if waking's a concern, you know, again, if possible, we would like to do a weighted feed. That doesn't always happen at the evaluation, but we always make a note to make sure we're doing that at one of the first visits, just to get an idea of what the baby is taking in at the breast. And then we do also have a tool called the LAT, which is a lactation assessment tool. It's kind of just a checklist that goes through and helps us observe things that are happening or areas of concerns before, during, and after a feeding. We don't always pull that out after, you know, doing this a few times. You kind of just have it memorized so you know what you're looking for. But that's typically what an evaluation looks like. And then, you know, for early intervention, typically, we're looking for a delay in a developmental area, but breastfeeding isn't necessarily a developmental area we're scoring. So we use informed clinical opinion pretty often for these babies to qualify them, unless there's a medical diagnosis that would make them automatically eligible.
What is a weighted feed?
So that is where we would weigh the baby before a feeding, preferably just in a dry diaper, and then mom would nurse the baby, and then we would weigh after. And they're not always super accurate, just depending on the scale, but it gives us a rough estimate of how many ounces the baby is taking in at the feed.
Okay, awesome. I can imagine that parents are often pretty emotional surrounding this topic, just, you know, worried about their baby and feeding. How do you guys as providers prepare yourself and help families during these highly emotional times?
You're right, Kelly, that this is a highly emotional time. I think parents have an expectation of what it's going to look like. When you add that in with not sleeping and the challenges that come along with breastfeeding and the emotional hormone changes that are going on for mom, it's just a lot. But Caitlin and I both have experience breastfeeding, so we can kind of lean into those challenges that we've faced personally, and we can show compassion. Just like with every evaluation, we will meet the family wherever they are and walk into life however it looks and come alongside them to partner with them. I really try and put myself in mom's shoes. Me personally, I've experienced vaginal birth. I've had a C-section. I've had a VBAC. I've had breastfeeding go amazing. I've had breastfeeding go completely terrible. So I can relate to a lot of different situations. And I really try to just show compassion and listen to what is going on before I start offering solutions. But one other thing I really like to do is remind myself of the why behind breastfeeding. So then I also, if need be, can remind the family. And just real quick, I want to let you know some of the different benefits per the CDC of breastfeeding. Babies have lower risk of asthma, obesity, type 1 diabetes, severe lower respiratory disease, a lower risk of ear infections, of SIDS, and of GI infections. And then moms also benefit because they will have a lower risk of breast cancer, ovarian cancer, type 2 diabetes, and high blood pressure. So there are a lot of benefits to breastfeeding. So I like to have that in the back of my mind as a tool. But also, we know that breastfeeding does not work for everyone. So I always also go in with the mindset of, I would never tell mom you have to breastfeed because there are other options. Moms can pump and give bottles, and there are several formulas that families can also use. So it's nice to know that this isn't an end-all, and we, Caitlin and I, and early intervention in general, will help just make sure the baby is getting fed.
Yeah, and I think as a parent, I mean, I remember being a new parent and, you know, knowing all of those benefits of breastfeeding and so then wanting to breastfeed, and then, you know, I think sometimes personally, like maybe there's some guilt surrounding like, oh, I can't breastfeed now. I have to give my baby formula. And I think that could be hard for parents when breastfeeding is, you know, pushed upon them.
Absolutely. Yep. That's why we come with the mindset of supporting the family however they want to support, and also letting them know that formula has a lot of great things that will allow their baby to grow and develop and flourish as well.
Which is the most important thing.
Absolutely.
We just want to make sure that baby is gaining weight and is happy and fed.
Right. Yes.
And that makes, I think I heard one of you say earlier, like just that positive relationship, right, between mom and baby. If it's already hard, and Kelsey, you mentioned like sleep deprivation, hormones, feeding time is hard, we want that bond or that relationship between mom and baby to be happy and positive and going well also, right?
Yes.
I'm thinking.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, you both shared that there are some common questions you get asked during visits, and we wondered if you'd mind answering some of those for us.
Absolutely.
Wow. How did you guys time that so perfectly? Okay. One of the questions you said you get asked often was, how do I know if my baby is getting enough milk?
I feel this is a question we get asked so often. This could be either a family who maybe had an older sibling who they bottle fed, and you know exactly how much baby is getting because you know how much went into the bottle. Or maybe this is just a first-time mom who has no idea if baby's getting enough milk and really wants to know what to look for. So we want to make sure that the baby is responsive, is interactive, that you are seeing some periods of awakeness. In those itty-bitty babies, when we get told, oh, they're such a good baby, they sleep all day, there can be a cycle of baby sleeping because they're not getting enough nutrients and do not have the energy to wake up and say that they want food. So back to poop from Dana's episode, we also care about poop. We would like 4 poopy diapers on day 4, and we want that to continue through the first month. By day 5, we want baby to start gaining weight. So we know that breastfed babies typically lose weight after being born. We want them to reverse the weight loss and start going back up on the scale by day 5, and hopefully by that 2-week mark, they are back to birth weight. And then just keep growing. We look for about 1 ounce per day in those early times that we want weight gain to always continue. And then for those older babies, we want to have moms be really aware of hunger cues. We know feeding goes the best when baby is hungry. So by teaching mom how to look for the hunger cues and then really trusting the baby, which I feel this is a theme that has been on several of our podcasts, if everything is going well, we can trust that the baby will tell you when they're hungry. And then we ideally want the baby to finish the feed by pulling off and then have that very happy, content look about them of a very full belly.
We're not getting away from poop, and certainly Dr. Delgado talked about those feeding cues, and babies can show them. So, yeah. Well, another question that we have, or that you all shared with us, that you get asked is, how often and long should my baby feed? Tell us about that.
So those newborns are going to be feeding a lot. I'm going to say 10 to 12 times a day. So if you do the math, that could be every 2 hours. We know that breast milk can be absorbed more quickly and the baby will go through it quicker. So they're going to need to be fed more often. So it will feel like you are feeding all the time. And that is okay in those starting days and weeks. We also want to make sure that when you're feeding the baby, that the baby is actually eating. So we're listening for the sound of swallowing milk. If the baby is just on the breast, and using you as a pacifier, that cannot count as actual eating time. So a baby who can efficiently latch and eat, they can typically feed within, I'm going to say 15-ish minutes. Everyone's a little bit different. If a baby is on for less than 5 minutes, they're most likely not getting enough milk. If a baby is on for 20 or more minutes, then I feel like they might be using mom as a pacifier. So those different cues are things that we're looking for. But yeah, early on, you're going to feed a lot. Later in life, maybe around 2 to 3 month mark, then we're going to see them a little more spread out. And then as the baby gets older, we sometimes get those longer stretches overnight of babies going 4, 5, even 6 hours between feeds, which is always something parents look forward to.
Yeah, the glorious, glorious stretch of sleep.
And I do just want to add in there, I feel like we get this question a lot, especially with first-time moms, about the frequency of feeds because they feel like baby's eating all the time because the internet likes to tell us that the perfect baby can go 3 to 4 hours between feeds. So why is my baby wanting to eat every 2 hours? That's because it's normal. So we always like to mention, and just a lot of parent education on what typical feeding looks like, even if the internet wants to tell you that something is wrong with your baby eating a lot. It is not. It's very normal.
One question I had, like you mentioned, like kind of 5 to 15-ish minutes. Is that on one breast or is that both sides, like, you know, that same time on both sides?
I'm going to say that can vary mom to mom because supply varies so much from mom to mom. So if a mom has a very large milk supply, they're going to be able to alternate breasts between feeds. And maybe just one side is going to be enough for that baby, as long as mom is seeing the sucking, is hearing the swallowing throughout that whole time. But if baby slows down after one breast, then we recommend moms to try and burp the baby and then relatch on that other side so that they can get a full feed.
Caitlin, how would you answer a parent that said, you know, how do I increase my milk supply?
Yes, this is another question we get constantly, especially like Kelsey mentioned, in those first few days, if we get in there early enough where parents feel like they don't have the milk supply yet, or if it's been a while and they're having to supplement. But the most important factor for increasing milk supply is frequent milk removal. There's a lot of fads and products out there that claim to be the cure-all of increasing your milk supply, but the only thing that really works is removing the milk from the breast. This is, you know, you have to take the milk away for your body to refill the breast to continue feeding the baby. So we want to make sure mom is either feeding or pumping in place of a feed on a regular schedule that mimics that baby's feeding pattern. So if we're struggling with a latch and baby isn't able to feed from the breast every time baby's hungry, then mom needs to be pumping in place of that. Or if mom is offering the breast and baby isn't getting a full feed, again, due to some latch concerns, mom needs to pump after to make sure that she is fully emptying the breasts to cue her body that we need to make more milk. Baby's going to be hungry again soon. So that's the biggest thing we need to work on. And, you know, when Kelsey and I are in there working on increasing milk supply, we want to make sure that the latch is optimal. So we're working on that placement of baby and then also making sure that mom is able to pump correctly so she can efficiently remove all of the milk. And then we also want to make sure that mom is taking care of herself, staying hydrated, eating, you know, a good amount of foods. When you're producing milk, you need to increase your calorie intake. So making sure that mom's eating a good amount of food with healthy fats and protein and all of that. And like I said, you know, there's no magic product that is going to increase your milk supply overnight, but those are the big things to work on to make sure that mom can get all of the milk out and her body can keep making more.
Yeah. I feel like when my girls were little, I heard about a tea you could drink to increase your milk supply or something like that. I don't know.
Cookies and things. I mean, there's some research behind oatmeal helping just increase supply. But again, you can't just eat a bunch of oatmeal and then not feed your baby every 2 hours or pump every 2 hours and just assume. Because we do get that too, where it's moms want to increase milk supply, but they're only pumping, you know, maybe 2 or 3 times a day. And that's not going to tell your body we need to make
more. Right. Especially if you said like in those first few weeks, they might be feeding 10 to 12 times a day, right? So that would be, if you're saying replace like
a pump for a feed or something like we would need, they would need to be doing that.
Yes. And it is. I mean, it can be a lot of work if you do have to include pumping in there to help increase that milk supply. It can feel like another job. Ideally isn't a long-term problem that they have. Once we can get that supply up, it should stay, unless, you know, sometimes there's fluctuations with illness or things like that.
Okay. Well, Caitlin, another question that I believe you all get asked is about pumping, and if, you know, the moms are pumping correctly and how often should they pump? How do you answer that?
Yes. So, and that ties into, you know, the frequent milk removal is making sure we're pumping as often as the baby is feeding. And we, you know, a lot of times we'll go in there and talk a lot about what pumping looks like, and moms might not know that they need to be measured for the right size pump flange, and that's the plastic or silicone part that attaches to the breast to pull milk out. So we can go in and help measure mom to make sure that she's using the right size of flange to have appropriate milk removal. If the flange is too small or too big, it's not going to effectively stimulate the nipples to produce and release that milk. So we want to make sure that the nipple is fitting in the flange properly. And then helping mom figure out how often she needs to pump, which, like we kind of mentioned, is as often as the baby is eating or in place of a feed. So those are the big things. And then, you know, every mom is different with her levels that she can tolerate with the pump. So we want to make sure moms can have the pump as strong as they can go without it being uncomfortable. We don't want mom to ever have any pain while pumping. Same as at the breast. We don't want any pain. That is a sign that something is going on. So yeah, those are the biggest things. And kind of like what Kelsey mentioned with the timing of how long babies eat, we don't want pumping to exceed 20 minutes unless we're trying something which is called power pumping, which is a technique we can use to increase. Yes, I know it's quite the term, but it's like 10 minutes on the pump, 10 minutes off, 10 minutes on, 10 minutes on for like an hour just to cue your body like, oh, keep making more.
Power pump.
Power pumping. I know, right? Makes you sound like you're a bodybuilder going in for a power pump. But yeah, so typically though, we don't want to go over 20 minutes at a pumping session. So just looking to see when the milk stops flowing and not going past that time.
So Kelsey, I know that one of the questions that gets asked a lot is, why won't my baby latch? And what should I do? How do you respond to this?
Yes, this is another topic that gets brought up a lot. And if a baby won't latch at the breast, it's very difficult to feed the baby breast milk from the breast. So we're going to start with going back to square one. Is the baby hungry? So we really want to watch for those hunger cues and make sure we are offering food when the baby is hungry, because things will go much better at that point. And then when we're in the house, we help mom with positioning, because very often we see the baby being held in a way that is not conducive to them breastfeeding. It's different, especially if a baby has been bottle fed up to this point. It's a different process. And we encourage mom to tuck baby in tummy to tummy. We want the baby lined up, ears, shoulders, hips in a line, and stacked vertically on top of each other, which is much harder over the podcast to explain. But in person, we are helping mom position that baby. And then we want the baby's nose to be opposite mom's nipple. So when we're bottle feeding, the nipple is going straight into the baby's mouth from the bottle. That is not the same approach that we take when baby is breastfeeding, because we want the baby's chin to come in first so that baby will get that wide open mouth and then go on the breast. So it takes practice. And I like to tell moms, every time you give the baby the opportunity to breastfeed, you're letting baby learn how to breastfeed. Even if baby does not get a full feed, we are encouraging moms to keep trying. They can always give a bottle afterwards, because it takes a little time for babies to learn if this is something that we're doing after they have already been feeding a different way. For those newborns who are breastfeeding from the get-go, the skin-to-skin is so important. This is something that the baby-friendly hospitals have started implementing on their maternal floors. where they really encourage babies to have skin-to-skin contact with mom right after being born. We know that this skin-to-skin is even beneficial up to 4 months old. So if a baby is just struggling to latch at the breast, we'd like to tell moms just reset. If mom's comfortable, strip down to whatever she's comfortable to, have the baby just in a diaper and put that baby on your chest, skin to skin, to just help relax everybody and start over. Because as we've mentioned before, this can be very stressful and emotional, and you just want the baby to eat. So kind of that reset button of taking a minute, taking our deep breaths and trying again, getting that baby positioned so that they can have a successful latch really will help things go better.
Yeah. Could you just share a couple of the feeding cues that moms might, since we, if we have any moms that are listening to this podcast, what might they be looking for?
We like to catch the feeding cues before our baby is fully crying and upset. So we like to wait until baby is what we call quiet alert. So they're starting to wake up a little bit. They're looking around. They're maybe sucking on their hands, kind of turning their head back and forth, which is what we call rooting, looking for the breast. So those are the big ones that we like to see. And those are always a good time to start offering the breast. I think, again, this takes some parent coaching because we think, oh, wait till the baby's crying. When the baby's crying, then they're going to open their mouth and latch on. But we want to catch them before they get really upset, because we want them to have that intentional mouth opening to latch onto the breast instead of just being shoved on because they're crying and their mouth is open then. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like Kelsey mentioned, having good position to put baby in that close to the breast so we can have a successful latch is really important, because it is a natural thing for babies to want to latch on. We just have to give them the time to do it. So reflecting with mom on what their feeding routine typically looks like, a lot of times I'll suggest, okay, you know, it's pretty consistent where every 2 hours, baby's starting to yell because they want to eat right now, maybe 15 minutes before then. Try some skin to skin, get them comfortable, and just let them take their time getting to the breast. And then, you know, a lot of times we have a more successful feed.
I can imagine that would be, if baby's already crying, it's maybe a little harder to get that latch. Mm-hmm. You know, and as a parent, I remember when my girls cried, I would start to get anxious. Absolutely. And like, yes. Oh my God, I gotta hurry up, you know, that kind
Everyone
of thing.
Everyone is stressed.
Uh-huh. Kelly?
Did you ask about positions?
Well, we already talked about that.
The different positions?
There are different positions. Yes. Sorry, that's where I got.
Sorry, I was like, well, there's, you know.
You took a turn, Leslie, not me.
I did.
Yes. So there are a lot of different positions, and it totally depends on what mom is comfortable with and what works best for mom and baby. Different ones to try. So we just want to make sure they're comfortable. And like Kelsey mentioned, we want to make sure that baby is in a good line, tummy to tummy with mom, with arms around mom's breast or chest. So the most common one we see is the cross cradle, where baby is across mom's tummy. Mom can support the back of baby's head with one hand and kind of guide baby to the breast with the other hand. There's also the football hold, where mom is supporting baby kind of on the side of her body. And baby's kind of looking up at the breast, so holding like a football under the breast. This one is great for newborns when they're really tiny. It can be a challenge as baby gets bigger and starts to kick and like catapults off the back of the couch. So we like to try that one, you know, earlier on, but it's not always a long-term position. But it really is just trial and error to see what works best for mom and baby. There's also an option to put baby tummy to tummy with mom, but upright. So baby's legs are around mom's thighs and kind of facing right into mom. And it just depends on, you know, what our concerns are with baby's latch, if different positions would be more effective, and then what mom is comfortable with.
Yeah. And I think as like a new mom, I mean, and maybe it's changed because it's been a minute since I've been a new mom, but I feel like you're just given your baby and here you go. Like, now you feed your baby, but you're not really told about all the, like, there's other positions you can feed your baby in. So anyway, what about nipple pain between feeds? What do you guys do? What do you say?
That is a reoccurring question that we get as well. And I just like to think back to in nursing school, where we learned that everyone feels pain differently. It's hard to have just a scale of this is appropriate and this is not, because it's different for everyone. I was in a lactation class, and at one point they had you squeeze the skin between your pointer finger and your thumb. And they said, squeeze that, squeeze it pretty hard. It doesn't feel great, but it's not exactly pain. It's very uncomfortable. And they said that that is acceptable at the beginning journey of breastfeeding. So we know that there is going to be some uncomfortableness for moms who are beginning the breastfeeding journey. One study showed that pain is worse on day 3, and then it stays a little bit painful, or we're going to say uncomfortable, up until about that 3-week mark. At that point, baby hopefully has figured out how to latch, how to feed, and how to stop a feed. So pull off the breast without mom experiencing any pain at all. One of the things I think we do see babies do a lot is not open their mouth to pull off the breast. So their mouths are closed and they're pulling their head back and mom's nipple is going with it. This is not something that we want to have happen. We are not a to-go restaurant, I heard. Restaurant from one of the classes I was in. We don't do to-go. So baby has to stay and then open their mouth before they leave. I also liked this teacher referred to it not being a 24-hour diner. So later in life, we want to let the toddler know that it's not, if mom does not want the toddler to come up, raise their shirt, nurse for 5 seconds, and then go about their day, she doesn't have to do that. But sorry, that's a little off topic. Back to pain. So for pain, there is a new product that is a silver cap. I say new because it was not around when I was having babies. And this is something that I have had moms have a lot of success with. It is something that they wear under their bra between breastfeeding sessions. And it's a natural product that helps with inflammation. It decreases infection. And moms have really said this helps them. There are other products. There's breast pads and different things that you can wear. And you can always put an over-the-counter cream. Some moms use coconut oil over their nipple to help. If a nipple is ever cracked and bleeding, which we also see, and baby is reopening that wound every time they feed, that's when I recommend mom call their provider, because there's also a prescription level cream that will help if mom is getting an infection, because we don't want to go down that route of baby now potentially drinking from an infected breast and then passing that infection on. So if it's just pain, there's preventative ways to help. And then also thinking about those different positions that Caitlin just spoke about. So if we always use the same position and baby is maybe not having the best latch, the same pressure is going to go on to the same part of the nipple every time. And we're going to damage that nipple more quickly. In those beginning weeks when we're trying to figure out breastfeeding, there is a benefit to changing positions so that the pressure is differently, like placed differently on the nipple. It's spread out a little bit. And also we know that babies can drain the breast differently if we allow for those different positions in the early weeks. So all of those are ways that we can help address that nipple pain.
Great. Thanks for sharing.
Well, Caitlin, one of the other questions that you all shared, you're asked often, is do you think my baby has a tongue tie? How do you address that?
Yes. Tongue ties are a hot topic these days.
Hot topic.
Yes. So we, you know, I always like to say from the get-go, as lactation counselors, we cannot diagnose a tongue tie. A medical professional has to make that diagnosis. So we can chat about things that we see, but we cannot make that diagnosis. And, you know, I think a lot of times we can be quick to clip the tie because parents hope that it's just going to be this immediate miraculous fix to pain during breastfeeding, but that's not always the case. There's not a lot of research that supports clipping that tongue tie for a variety of reasons. Leslie, I'm sure you get this too as a speech pathologist. If it's going to help my kid talk more or be able to say their sounds, there's just not a lot of research to support that at all. So I always recommend, you know, going through lactation support first. because babies can be totally successful breastfeeding with no pain and efficiently, even if there is a bit of a tie. And everyone has the lingual frenulum, which is what people, when they see, you know, that little piece of tissue between the tongue and the bottom of the mouth, they think that, oh, we have a tongue tie. But that's just a natural part of anatomy. And it does stretch as baby gets older. We like to practice a lot of different things before we just jump to clipping it, because it can be a traumatic procedure for baby and for mom. And sometimes it reattaches and then you have to do it all over again.
Yes.
So going back to the positioning, a lot of times trying different positionings like the upright position or the football hold can help baby be able to feed without giving mom any pain, even if there is maybe a slight tie. Just based on where the nipple is in the mouth, we can kind of help baby be successful. So there's a lot of things to try before going right to clipping that tongue tie. And again, it's not always a solution. Sometimes, especially if the baby's older, it can lead to more difficulty feeding because there's so much trauma with their little mouth. And, you know, there's the follow-up care is not great, having to stretch it either. So going through all of the options before pursuing that procedure. And talking, you know, with your pediatrician as well on what they think. So there's a lot of things to consider, but we don't always immediately recommend that as the perfect fix.
I am so glad that we went back to the positioning, because the last few questions, you guys have referenced that. And I was just like, well, we've already discussed it. So, I mean, you know. Okay.
Let's tie it all together. Well, thanks for addressing that. Caitlin, I know it's a hot topic. Moving on, are there resources available for families that want to give their baby breast milk, but mom is unable to produce for different reasons?
Sure. So there's one resource in this situation that we can send families to, or that we choose to, and that is going online to themilkbank.org. And within that website, they list different areas that have regulated breast milk that families can either donate or can have to give to their baby. The one here most local to us is on the Missouri side in the health department. And that is one where if you wanted to give your baby breast milk and we're not able to for whatever reason, that is somewhere you could start to see what they have available for you.
And what is the difference by going to the health department? Why would that be safe for a mom?
Well, there are many ways you can get breast milk on the internet through other ways, but those are not regulated at all. And there's not as much screening as to what may be in the breast milk, like the pasteurization or cleaning process would different. So we, and probably a lot of people listening, have friends who maybe have a trusted family member or friend who they feel comfortable sharing that breast milk. And I think that does happen, but we do not recommend that you just purchase something on the internet without knowing where it comes from. So that would be the benefit. And then babies who are in the NICU or hospitals, they do have a milk bank resource within the hospital. But as far as I know, in our community, that is not a resource they are sharing community wide, probably because they are using it all for their babies who are the NICU babies. Inpatient.
Yeah.
Well, thinking as you're moving through that support with lactation, are there other areas of development that the baby may need support with, either after lactation's been resolved or even, you know, while you're still working through lactation? And if so, what are some of the supports the baby might need?
Yes. So, you know, we don't always see babies needing long-term support with early intervention, because they're having some difficulties with latching. The only time you would see that really is if there's another medical diagnosis that's underlying the cause, like low tone in their mouth and bodies, if they have any sort of cleft lip or palate, things like Down syndrome can affect feeding just because, again, the tone and musculature in the mouth. One thing we can see that kind of correlates with challenges with breastfeeding can be torticollis. So if baby has a preference to one side or some tightness in their neck to where it's challenging for them to turn a certain way or use their tongue appropriately to remove that milk, a lot of times we can work with a physical therapist or occupational therapist to help with some stretching to get baby a little more mobile so they're able to latch well at the breast.
Awesome. Thanks. All right. Follow me through here, ladies. I promise I will make the connection from restaurant to restaurant. As I teased earlier, all four of us have worked in the restaurant biz, and we were going to play a quick game of you know you've worked in a restaurant when. So I'm going to go first. You know you've worked in a restaurant when you still have server nightmares and you haven't worked in a restaurant in over 20 years. And these nightmares consist of you are forever getting drinks for the whole restaurant, but you're the only server, but you never quite make it to the table. Like you're just always getting these drinks and you're just thinking, oh my gosh, I've got to get it to the table, but I can't make it there. And I would say this is equivalent to the old college dream of it's finals, but you never went to class. It's just kind of like pure nightmare. Anyways, Caitlin, you're up.
You know you have worked in a restaurant when someone blames you for not liking the food that they ordered, because that always makes so much sense.
Right?
And when people show up right before closing and expect to be seated and have their, five-course meal, just taking their sweet time and are nice and high maintenance.
Yes.
Leslie, you're up.
You know you've worked in a restaurant when you know the regulars order on special night, or you can recite their order or their drink order. So you've worked in a restaurant, if it's that like cheers, everybody knows your name, you maybe dream about the specials. I mean, I worked at Tanner's, so I could recite, you know, steak night, booger night, all this stuff.
What's booger night?
Burger, but they called it booga.
Booga. Mm-hmm.
Booga. Yeah. I think they still do. Kelsey, you're up. Okay. You're going to connect it all for us. Let's do it.
You know you've worked in a restaurant when you serve a customer what appears to be a beautiful, crispy, golden chicken tender. But unfortunately, the fryer cook had not cooked it long enough. And so when they cut into the chicken, it is raw and cold on the inside. I have done this before. It was not a fun night at the restaurant. But I can relate this to the mom's experience of everything looking perfect on the outside. And then, for whatever reason, baby isn't growing or mom is in extreme pain. This is similar to the raw chicken. Just because things are looking okay on the outside doesn't always mean that it's going the way it's supposed to. So that's when you bring us in to help address some of those underlying issues.
Well, wow. And that's how we connect restaurant to restaurant. Uncooked chicken tenders. Who knew? Well, thank you to Kelsey and Caitlin for being our guest on the Early Intervention Podcast. We enjoyed having you. As we wrap up our time together, is there a tip or strategy you want to leave providers or caregivers with? Caitlin, you can go first.
Yeah. So my biggest tip, you know, I share this with friends when they find out they're pregnant, is just making sure that you prepare yourself before you give birth. I think breastfeeding is something that we kind of forget about as everyone's getting really excited preparing for baby to be here and preparing for the actual birth itself. But making sure you have some knowledge before you have baby in your arms in the hospital, and then also finding some resources if you are struggling to breastfeed after, having those in your back pocket so you know who to reach out to for support if needed.
I'm going to add on to that just a little bit. It is so important to be prepared and to have some knowledge about breastfeeding going in. I felt as a first-time mom, I took the breastfeeding class. I thought I kind of knew what was going to happen, but I did not understand colostrum, which we didn't even get into today, and why I was producing a drop of it. But this is normal. So first-time moms, know that you will not have tons of milk. You're going to start with colostrum, and it could be day 5 before your milk comes in. So don't give up in those first few days when you feel like you're giving your baby nothing, because you are giving them liquid gold with that colostrum. And just knowing that there are different reasons that mom's milk could be delayed, C-section, gestational diabetes, first-time baby, or first-time moms, those are all reasons for delayed milk. So just don't give up.
Never give up.
Well, as part of our podcast, we want to highlight someone or something as it relates to early intervention by giving them a shout out. May is National Speech Language Hearing Month, and we want to give a shout out to all the speech language pathologists and audiologists for their work with individuals with communication disorders and hearing impairments. So shout out to Caitlin. May also, what? Yes, yes, yes. May also celebrates Nurses Appreciation Week. And so we want to give a shout out to all the nurses for their invaluable contributions and real life challenges they face every day. So thank you, Kelsey.
Thanks, ladies. Feel free to email Leslie and I topics you're interested in hearing about. Send those emails to earlyinterventionpodcast@gmail.com. We want to thank Melissa Schlegel for being the first to email the Early Intervention Podcast with topics and potential guest ideas. She gets the award, and we appreciate hearing from you guys. We want to thank Friends of a Toddler Services for their support with the podcast. Friends of a Fit Toddler Services develops, maintains, and funds additional services and programs for children served by Infant Toddler Services of Kansas, serving Johnson County. They are funded through private donations, fundraising events such as the annual Fall Ball Gala and Tee Off for Tots Golf Tournament, which we just had and was a success. You can learn more about their work by visiting our website, itsjc.org.
That's a wrap on our episode of the Early Intervention Podcast. We hope you enjoyed our guests. Our next episode, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Bonnie Kroom, a pediatric gastroenterologist doctor at Children's Mercy Hospital. So you can look for episode 5 titled Tiny Tummies, Big Questions to drop on July 1st. You can listen to the Early Intervention Podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and Amazon Music.
And it's time to say goodbye.
Until next time.